everybody. This is Robin Yu from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome back. Today, if this is your first time here to the show, well, welcome back to the show. Welcome back to the conversation. And this show is about the global language industry, how people are building and connecting and increasingly finding technology to reshape the way we communicate, the way we deal with each other, the way we talk to each other, or the way we care for each other. Today, I have a guest who sits at the very different intersection that is a bit unusual to explore. He is a functional neurosurgeon practicing near Philadelphia, which means he spends his day operating on human nervous system, specifically targeting pain at its source. He is the director of functional neurosurgery and an associate, I believe, at the Neurosurgical Associate of Lancaster, and the president of the Executive Pain Committee at the ANS, and also at CNS, and is the president-elect of the American Society of Pain and Neuroscience. He's also a strategic advisor of Synerfuse, a medical device company that has developed something called the eCLIF, a technology which I want to understand a little bit better today, and hopefully we, by the end of this conversation, we know what eCLIF is. As you might know, and you might be wondering, for instance, what a neurosurgeon is doing on the Localization Fireside Chat podcast. I'm glad you asked. And the answer is, the best conversation I've had on this show is when two worlds collide. I love those conversations. Language is everywhere, and specifically in medicine. The gap between surgical innovation and patient who needs the care or who needs the medical assistance. Generally speaking, in some cases, there is some language gap, and this is where language can help. But in this case, today, I invited Dr. Stephen Falowski, who is here with us, to talk about his work, his technology, and where the two worlds overlap. Dr. Stephen Falowski, welcome to the show. Really glad you are with me. I really appreciate you taking the time. I understand you were in the operating room. You came out to have a conversation with us. Sorry to take you away from what you do, life-saving work, but thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate being on the show.
No, I appreciate you having me on the show. This is a great opportunity.
Thanks so much. And Stephen, if you don't mind me addressing you, Stephen, it makes it a little easier for me.
Yeah, very good. Stephen's perfect.
As we say on this show, Stephen, everybody's got a story. Why don't we start with this one? What is your story?
Sure. So, we'll fast forward to now. I'm a functional neurosurgeon, but obviously it was the past to get there. Oddly enough, I was actually the first person in my family to go to college, nevertheless become a neurosurgeon. But when I was actually finishing up college and going into med school, this is now very much the early 2000s. So I graduated med school in 2004. It was like this kind of like uprising of people talking about artificial intelligence and the brain-computer interface. And what being a functional neurosurgeon was what was considered the most cutting edge at the time. So even though I went through my regular training as a neurosurgeon, which is 7 years, I did an additional fellowship as well in functional neurosurgery. I did extra training during my residency as well in spinal procedures. So the things that functional neurosurgeons can do, though, is that we can alter the nervous system by putting electrodes or chips on the brain, electrodes or chips on the spine. At the time when I was finishing my training and coming out, the most common one that we would use is what's called a spinal cord stimulator, where we put an electrode on the spine. And the most common reason we did that was actually to block the transmission of painful signals. So my story was is that I wanted to become a neurosurgeon. I found it was one of the hardest things to do in medicine. It's considered one of the hardest trainings to do and the longest. But I always like a good challenge. I always used to joke with my mom that if I wasn't a neurosurgeon, I'd probably be a very high-end mechanic for a car, because I love to just fix things and I love things that are hard to figure out. But that's where we now fast forward to where I am today, which is I still try to remain on the cutting edge of functional neurosurgery and by doing these what we call neuromodulation, modulating the nervous system with electricity.
So if you were at a dinner party, Stephen, and somebody asked you what you do, how do you explain that?
I usually start off slow. I'm like, I'm a physician, you know, and then I hope that they don't go into what kind of physician, because then it always turns into, oh, so you're a brain surgeon. I like to think I'm a pretty down-to-earth brain surgeon, since you know, simple country doc.
So you said something very interesting, isolating the pain signal. Would you mind explaining that for the people that don't know what that means? Because I didn't know up till just a few seconds ago that you can isolate specific signals in the nervous system from other signals.
Yes, absolutely. And the technology has just continued to improve. Believe it or not, spinal cord stimulators, which are electrodes that we place on the spinal cord, have been around since the late 1980s. But not much in the technology changed up until around 2010 to 2015, where all the science just really started. We dove into like really understanding the mechanism of action of what we were doing, trying to figure out how to isolate different types of nerves and different types of pain signals, and realizing that even something as simple as light touch is not the same way perceived as pain, even in the same area on your hand. And so we dove into like how to isolate very specific nerves on the spinal cord based on the way we actually stimulate. It's what we call now waveforms, which is basically stimulation parameters and how we stimulate those nerves. But essentially, what we used to do in the past with spinal cord stimulators is we would put an electrode on your spine, so your sensory nerves, the what feel on your spine, and we would generate tingling sensations where the pain was. So if you had pain in your left foot, we would create a gentle tingling sensation in your left foot. And what would happen is that would those nerve fibers of feeling the tingling would override the painful fibers. That's historically how it always worked. Now, though, with the science, we can actually isolate very specific fibers, and we can do it without creating any sensations. We can just cancel out those nerves or inhibit those nerves and just block the pain from that specific region.
So what's the difference between this methodology versus painkillers?
Very different, actually. I mean, with painkillers such as opioids, one is they work by a different mechanism of action. They work on chemicals within the nervous system to try to alter very specific receptors that are feeling the pain. And their goal is to block those receptors so when the pain's coming in, you don't feel it. But as you can imagine with opioids, and we've had the opioid epidemic in the United States for years now, and it's, you know, you could have many side effects from it. You could have addiction that comes with it. Just even the cost of healthcare with opioids and what it does to patients. When we talk about neuromodulation, we're talking about something that there is no adverse events. There are no side effects we don't want. There are no addiction that comes with it. The idea of a lot of these therapies is to prevent people from needing to go on things like opioids long term.
Absolutely. Now, you perform something called functional neurosurgery. I mentioned a little bit in my intro. You know, for people like who don't know, never heard of functional surgery, would you mind explaining what that is?
Yeah. Functional neurosurgery is a term we use for a very specific specialty in neurosurgery. And our specialty is usually in either minimally invasive approaches or the use of what we call neuromodulation, which is the use of basically placing electrodes either on the spinal cord or electrodes in the brain. So the most common reason on the spinal cord is to treat chronic pain. But we were actually treating things like spinal cord injury and paralysis. In the brain, the most common reason we put electrodes in is to treat something like, say, Parkinson's disease or tremor, where we can eliminate your tremor by re-stimulating the motor areas of your brain to work normal again. So those are some of the most common reasons we now implant electrodes.
And for the audience who are not familiar with electrodes, these are not devices that you probably need to recharge with battery or anything like this, or they're forever, or do you have to replace them once in a while?
Yeah, so the best way, I think the best analogy is think of it as a pacemaker for your brain or a pacemaker for your spine. Essentially, it's an electrode that's either on the brain or a spinal cord, and then it connects to a generator or battery. On average, those batteries are just like pacemakers. They'll last, you know, anywhere from 7 to 10 years.
Okay. Now, initially, Stephen, you trained at Thomas Jefferson University, and you took a fellowship at Rush. Mm-hmm. At what point did pain management and neuromodulation stop being just especially and became something closer to a mission for you?
You know, I will say even during my training at Jefferson, I focused in a lot on chronic pain and specifically the spinal cord stimulators, because I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So even before getting to the end of my training and going to Rush in Chicago to do an extra functional fellowship, I was focusing in on this. Now, you have to remember, this is back in 2005, 2006, when I'm going through my training. That sounds so ancient now, 20 years ago.
Times fly, Stephen, times fly.
But, you know, at the time, this was all the cutting edge therapy. This is what people were talking about. We can implant chips in the brain. And, you know, now we're looking at all these companies that are out there now and their brain computer interfaces. And it's almost becoming a reality now. But in its infancy is when I was part of it, where we, you know, we were trying to treat things like epilepsy by putting in recording devices on the brain that could sense a seizure. And right before the seizure would happen, it would send a signal and stimulate the brain not to have the seizure. So these were all the most cutting edge things. And it was exciting for me. I was very passionate about taking part in it. So even in my training of residency, I did. And then I knew I would go on to do this, and my fellowship and then my whole career on it. So
now, what does a typical case look like and what's the outcome? So after going through a procedure like this or through a surgery, whatever you call it, the appropriate term for it, I'm thinking it's called procedure, what would be the outcome? And what is, you've done hundreds of these cases. I went through your bio, you've done hundreds of them. And it's like for somebody in your industry, this is quite the achievement and quite the CV, to be honest with you, quite the resume. Well,
thank you.
You've done this like sorry, my camera is, it does that all the time. It's AI. So one of the things is like, people would wonder, like, have you kept statistics of this? What would be the outcome? What was the outcome of your statistics? How many of these cases achieved the end results that you desired? How many of them did not improve life a little bit for these individuals or no? Can you walk us through that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so one of the things I also do in my own practice is I collect data on my patients. I do a lot of research and publications. It's something I'm very passionate about because one of the, when we look for new indications for what we do, a lot of the times that requires a very large, expensive study to do. And what ends up happening is the only people who could afford to do that or do that is industry, the companies that have the products. Right away, then there, you know, a lot of us feel or it's viewed that there's an inherent bias that can come with that, even though they do generate some of the best studies we have. But because of that, I also believe that as physicians, we need to continue to do our own data collection and show that. But what I want to show is that in my practice, I can mirror these amazing $20 million trials by the company and the results that they got, or I can get even better than them. So that's one of the reasons I've become very passionate about doing my own research. But the truth is, especially over the last 10 to 12 years, the success rates with what we do have skyrocketed. I remember, you know, when I was in my training, 2004, 2005, we used to have what we called the 50-50 club. It was 50% of patients got 50% pain relief. And when I look back at that now, I'm like, how did we ever think that that was like some of the greatest results you could have? Now we talk about 85, 90% of people could be essentially close to cured of their pain. You know, these are the type of numbers now we talk about what we're doing in studies, the indications that we're looking at and the different types of painful indication. And one of the things that, like I said, I was passionate about is I try to duplicate those same results in my practice and publish papers on it as well.
And Stephen, what do you rely the positive outcome on, the improvement in the positive outcome? What was the cause of it? Is it advancement technology, procedure techniques? What was it?
I would say it's a couple things, but one of the main things is obviously the improvement in the technology. But what really, I think, changed the way we even view what we're doing in this space and in this field was we took a step back and looked at how we actually stimulate the nerves, kind of what I said in the beginning. How can we actually isolate very specific fibers or nerve fibers to have the best results?
I think that's the biggest challenge, isn't it? Because the human body, especially on the spine area, there's thousands of nerves.
Exactly. And one of the things was trying to figure out where do we put these electrodes? Do we put it on a single nerve that's going, say, to your foot, the top of your foot? Or do we put it on your spine, which is controlling all the nerves from your back down? And where, and if we do that, where on the spine do we put it? So we started focusing a lot on that location, types of electrodes. But then the real game changer for us was really starting to study scientifically, what nerves do you stimulate and how do you stimulate them? You know, we used to just have, you know, everyone thinks it's just electricity. You just turn it on like you flip a switch. But there's many different ways that we can control that signal from stronger to wider to lower amplitudes to perceptions where you don't feel. You know, we always joke that, like, you know, sometimes animals hear things that we can't hear, but your nerves are the same way. I can stimulate the nerves on your spine where they don't actually, you don't feel that you're being stimulated, but we're blocking fibers or treating your pain. That's what really was the game changer for us and devoting a lot of energy, science, and research into that.
Now, we're talking about a specific way here to treat pain by the methodology you've been explaining to us. What other options currently available on the market and how do you rate them in comparison to the procedure that you offer?
Yeah, absolutely. So There's a spectrum of what we offer on the market to treat pain. Usually everything starts on the least invasive and moves to the most invasive, but there are some exceptions to that as well. But usually we start off with things like anti-inflammatory medications, muscle relaxants, especially physical therapy to try to see if we can, you know, say if you're having back pain, make sure that your alignment in your spine is correct. Make sure that your back muscles are strong. So we'll start with physical therapy. Then you can move on to things like the medications, whether it be opioids. Where the real crossroads is now whether or not you need spine surgery. So if you get imaging and MRI of your spine, maybe the spine surgeon says, oh, you know what, that disc has to be taken out, or you need a fusion, you need screws and rods in your spine to reconstruct it. Then the question is whether you have that surgery, which obviously is the most invasive of surgeries that as a spine surgeon we do, or do you go down the route of, like, say, something like a spinal cord stimulator where, well, we're going to say structurally your spine is okay, you're not compromising your nerves, let's just treat the pain instead of trying to reconstruct your spine, which is going to lead into the company Centrifuge that I basically partner with, or one of their strategic advisors, is one of the most common reasons we put in a spinal cord stimulator is because up to 30% of patients who have spinal fusions live in chronic pain afterward. And it's not that the surgeon did anything wrong. I do spine surgery as well. We do change the construct of your spine. We change the way it moves. We're putting screws and rods into something for every joint in your spine that's supposed to be moving, and we're stopping it from moving. That can create painful areas of your spine. And then the most common reason we put a stimulator in is to treat the pain after a surgery like that.
Now, since you mentioned it, what is the relationship and what is Centrifuge for you and the company itself? And what is the outcome you're seeing after Centrifuge is being used in some of your patients?
Yeah, absolutely. The Centrifuge partnered with a lot of spine surgeons, but also pain physicians, knowing that up to 30% of patients who have spine surgery, like a spinal fusion or even spinal decompression, meaning just removing the bone, up to 30% of those patients will live in chronic pain. Those are the people who were, you know, we were placing on opioids and everything. Now we're putting in the spinal cord stimulators for them. Centrifuge, the concept there is that, well, some patients need to have spinal fusion surgery. You have instability in your spine. You have nerve compromise. You know, the surgery has to be done, even though there may be a 30% chance of pain. What Centrifuge does is recognize that if we're taking those patients and putting stimulators in all of them anyway, what if we can prevent them from ever getting to the point that they have chronic pain? So the concept was, and we're done with the proof of concept study, was to put the stimulator in at the same time as the fusion surgery. And if you remember before, I talked about one of the things we've been really studying a lot and trying to learn is where to put these electrodes.
That's right, yeah.
So with Centrifuge, we actually put them directly on the single nerves that we're operating on at that spinal level. As opposed to with a spinal cord stimulator, we put it on your spinal cord, which stimulates hundreds of thousands of nerves.
So how are you able to narrow it down, Stephen? How are you able to narrow it down?
Yeah, so basically at the bottom part of your spine, your lumbar spine, you have nerves that come out. Those are the nerves that will go down your legs to, say, your foot, your knee, to control things. So whatever level we're operating on in the spine, so let's say we were operating on L4-5, so the fourth and fifth level, that nerve root, the L4 nerve root or the L5 nerve root, that nerve, we will put the electrode directly on that nerve because that's the level of the spine that we're operating on. We've been able now to do the proof of concept study, which had, I believe, 15 total patients in it. And to do this where we implant the electrode at the same time as the surgery, the outcomes were phenomenal. We followed these patients for up to 12 months, so 1 year. We basically dramatically decreased or almost eliminated their pain, what we call pain scores. So when you write your pain 2 out of 10, 5 out of 10, dramatically improve them. But what was even the most impressive was the patients continue to improve. So normally what happens is it takes about 3 months or so to recover from a spine surgery. But then usually what we see is that where those patients are, that 3 to 6 month mark is usually where they're going to be. However, with this study, it showed that by using these electrodes, these patients continued to improve even up to 1 year out. And then what was even most impressive was the opioid reduction in these patients, especially out to 1 year. We dramatically decreased the amount of opioids that these patients would normally need.
Of course, from a quality of life and better outcome, the better, the less pharmaceutical and chemical you put in your body, I'm assuming that's the general consensus, at least, yes. Unless you absolutely need it, the better it is. In terms of quality of life down the road, so you don't have to take medication or any chemically induced pills. Tell me, you're leading an executive pain committee. What is an executive pain committee at AANS? I didn't know there was a pain committee.
So basically, AANS is American Academy of Neurosurgeons, And then the CNS is the Congress of Neurosurgeons. It's our two biggest societies in the world for neurosurgery.
Okay.
Pain section is the, so neurosurgery divided into specialties, you know, brain aneurysms, brain tumors, and then we have a section specifically dedicated to pain. So I've been working with the neurosurgery societies for many years, my whole career, and was working obviously in the pain section and worked my way up, and then eventually become a board member, then the executive members are the treasurers, the secretaries, and then now I'm the president of the pain section for the neurosurgery society. So I represent everything that neurosurgeons do to try to treat pain.
And how do you balance, you know, there's, you know, you're working in the operating room all day, but how do you balance your work from shaping policies to helping patients and being, I don't know, do you sleep?
I probably could sleep a lot more than I do. I will say, when you're passionate about something, you find a way to do the things you want. And I try not to isolate myself to only one piece of what I'm doing. So, you know, I could be just a surgeon. And I finished up my OR cases and ran here to do this podcast because I love operating, and I, that's my part of like my job and what I do. But then, like I said before, I enjoy doing the research. I enjoy pushing the field forward. So I'll do analytics and collect data on my patients. Society work, like being the president for the pain section. I'm also incoming president for one of the largest interventional pain societies, ASPN, American Society of Pain and Neuroscience. That's all considered volunteer work, but you could also have the most impact in the space because we can train all the new physicians coming up. We can introduce a lot of the new therapies and technologies that are out there. But then the other piece of this, all this is, and is I like to also work with industry, companies like Centrifuge to advise them. I like working on things like product development so that I can be on the cutting edge of all the new products that are coming out. And I feel that by doing all these things, it has a very balanced, non-biased approach. I know, obviously, in the general public, that you always worry that physicians are, say, bought by companies, or, you know, I try to put my fingers in everything where it's volunteer work in societies, doing my own research, but also working for the, with the companies to try to make things better. I want to help them design better studies, better products, figure out the next new target for what we're looking for.
Is that the Centrifuge ET LIF? Is that that what it is?
Yeah. So the E
technology we described earlier.
Yes.
And that's not a it's an actual device. It is not a methodology. It's not a procedure. It is an actual device. Is it?
It's an actual device. Yeah. So the E is electrical, and T LIF is a spinal fusion. So it's an electrical spinal fusion. So they do the fusion with the screws and rods, and then they have a system that we implant that has what we call DRG electrodes, which is a fancy term for a very specific part of the nerve, and those electrodes then connect to a battery pack.
And how big are these devices? Do you notice them when you put them in as a patient or no?
No, for the most part, the electrodes on the spine are very small, sitting on the nerves. You won't feel those as a patient. The battery pack, we usually tuck pretty deep underneath the skin, where you, it's just like say a pacemaker for the heart. You may not be able to see it, but if you push on the skin, you're going to kind of know it's there. But all these devices are underneath the skin, you know, for essentially, for the most part, maintenance free.
And what about the quality of life for the patient right after the recovery of the surgery has been done? Do you notice that people can go back to live normally, or do they have to be cautious all the time and go back to, you know, feel the pain once in a while? What have you observed?
That's a great question. That's a great question because, you know, one of the things is, I mean, we would love to get 100% pain relief for everyone. But truthfully, everyone's nervous system is a little different. The factors that were involved in how they developed the pain were a little different. A lot of times, like what we shoot for, the improvement in your quality of life. If I can give you 80% pain relief, but now you're going to the mall with your grandkids, where before you were bedridden, that's a win for us. We want to give you a functional outcome too. That's the most important thing, is to get people either back to work, to get them functioning in society, able to do even just daily activities. I mean, I treat patients all the time that, you know, they're home. They can't even do the dishes because they can't stand long enough without getting back pain. They can't vacuum their own floors in their house. So if I can give them back the quality of life that they can do, you know, just even normal daily activities, they can maybe get out to the store, you know, and I always use the analogy of granny, you know, like if you give granny even 50% pain relief, she's probably going to go to the mall with her grandkids because now 100%. She can. So
100%. While I was doing the research, I've seen something called failed back surgery syndrome. Who named it and what is it?
I'll jokingly say it probably wasn't a spine surgeon. I will say, even as a spine surgeon, it's one of those terms that we really don't like because just the way it's worded, it means like inherently something went wrong or failed in the surgery, which is not actually the case. We now slowly got renamed as what we call post-laminectomy syndrome, which means post-surgery, you know, but now we actually call it PSPS, which is persistent spine pain syndrome. Trying to get away from the idea of failed surgery. But basically what it is is that there's up to 30% of patients, when we alter the dynamics of your spine, we can cause chronic pain. I think the important factor is, and this is why we don't like the term failed back surgery syndrome, is we can get x-rays and imaging and show that everything looks beautiful and perfect with the surgery we did. Our hands were perfect. We were very skilled doing it, but the patient still has pain. You know, so it's not that the surgeon did something wrong or that the surgery is failing. It's that there's so many things that are so complex in the spine and just generators of pain that we can't possibly treat them all.
Now, also found out that $20 billion a year downstream cost from a post-fusion chronic pain in the U.S. alone. In your opinion, from where, you know, your connection, your involvement in the industry quite a bit, where does that money actually go? More surgery, long-term opioid prescriptions, et cetera, I guess, in improving the quality of life, innovation? I have no idea.
Yeah. No, it's actually, you're correct with everything you said. It goes into the, I don't want to say it like this, but the endless abyss of just constantly treating somebody who has something that's not curable. So it's going to be treating them with opioids month after month, and that gets very expensive over time because they'll be on opioids, they'll be on nerve stabilizing medications, they'll be on anti-inflammatories. That's all contributing to it. They're going to go through multiple rounds of physical therapy. They're going to see pain physicians where they're going to get multiple interventions like injections in their back and what we call like nerve blocks, or, you know, it's they'll continue to come back to have those things done. But that's also where a lot of these therapies that we're looking at now come into play, is because our goal with these therapies like spinal cord stimulation is to potentially eliminate or at least dramatically reduce the use of healthcare dollars for all those other things. We've actually had multiple good studies now that have shown this, because you can imagine putting in an electrical device with a pacemaker attached to it and electrodes can be it's quite expensive up front. You know, it's not that, you know, a device, you know, let's say it costs $10,000 or $15,000 up front in healthcare. You know, it'll take a little bit of time for opioids to catch up to that. But what we've actually shown, though, is what we call break-even points for health economics. So it used to be our goal was 2 years, so that the stimulator is expensive up front, but after 2 years, it's now more cost-effective than have not done it, because you'll increase all the healthcare money. That's where the $20 billion is coming from, because those patients will continually be treated. The great thing is now is we've actually got it lower than it. We're at about a year and a half now for a break-even point where we'll get people off opioids. They won't need injections anymore. They won't need all the other medications, all the other therapies, and they go back to living a normal life. That break-even point now is about a year and a half.
And you know, it's very fascinating to hear you talk about this, because centrifugation is not everywhere in the U.S. I mean, you're still in an experimentation phase. You've done, 15 proof of concept procedures? Did I get that correct? And the data is showing promising data, 80% mm-hmm. improvement. How does that number translate, in your opinion, Stephen, to what you need to see before this becomes mainstream in hospitals?
Yeah, that's a really great question. One is, I do want to point out that the stimulators that we are, or the concept of the stimulation that we are using during the spinal fusion surgery, is what we've always used. And we know that it works, but we usually don't put it in until 2 years or 3 years after the spinal fusion, where those patients are living in pain for 3 years. So we know that stimulation works, and the nerves we're stimulating will actually treat the pain. The new concept is doing it so early on that you do it during a spinal surgery. That's where the data that we're going to need is exactly what we're doing now with Centrifuge. We're about to launch what we call the pivotal trial. The pivotal trial is going to be multiple centers across the country, and then to follow those patients for 1 year. And that usually a pivotal trial will lead to an FDA approval. So we are actually about to get started with that study.
Can you, if you don't mind, since you are involved quite a bit in the community of neurosurgeons, now, can you give us a little bit of an idea of the U.S. makeup of neurosurgeons? Like how many, where are they located? And is there more people going into the profession than people coming out? We hope so. People retire, obviously.
Yes, I will tell you, it's a little surprising, I think, when I tell people this, but there is not that many neurosurgeons in the country. There is about 3,500 total neurosurgeons in the country. But to put that into perspective, there's about 5,000 hospitals. So what that tells you is that there's a large amount of hospitals that are not even covered by neurosurgery. And Part of that is it's a little bit of a supply and demand. Neurosurgery has always been one of the hardest specialties to get through. It's the longest to get through, so we don't always attract a lot of the people. But we've also historically always kept our numbers low to make sure that the people who came out of training were some of the best people trained for the job. But I will tell you, for the near future, I don't think you're going to see a massive increase in the amount of neurosurgeons. But to put that into perspective, there's probably, 3,500 primary care physicians in every state. So to put those numbers into perspective. So there are not many neurosurgeons.
Are you involved on the academia side, Stephen, or no?
Very much so.
So you still play a role in the universities and try to get the young people into the profession?
I do. One of the things I actually do when I try to tie together the academia, universities with the societies is I do a lot of education on these, teaching how to put these stimulators in, teaching how to have the proper patient selection. So I run a lot of the educational or even what we call cadaver courses through the societies. We'll bring in the newer generation and all to show them what we believe is the right way to do these things.
You know, I was so impressed because when I was doing the research, like this is a topic I don't talk about on the channel, but I had to prepare for the conversation. So I've done a bit of a digging.
You've done a great job preparing. These are great questions.
I really appreciate it. I found something and I didn't know what it is. I thought I took a note of it. I'm going to ask you. Ultra low energy therapy.
Yes.
And, what is ultra low energy therapy? I think probably we've been talking about it. I'm just trying to explain the term to the audience who don't know about it. And what does it mean in context, in the context of the patient, the pain that they're trying to manage? Why does the low part matter? Because I'm assuming there's a difference between high energy and low energy, but we chose low energy because there's benefits to that.
Yeah, this was where the field was starting to change about 10 to 12 years ago, where we used to use a lot of high energy to stimulate the nerves in the spinal cord, so high that we were creating tingling sensations in your body to try to treat the pain. What we started realizing over time was we didn't need to do such high stimulation. We didn't need such high energy requirements. Turns out that your nerves actually respond to very, what we call like sub-threshold or very low settings where you don't even feel it, but the nerve is registering it. And what's happened now is we've got those parameters down to very low sub-threshold parameters. But some of the newest research that's been coming out the last 3 years is on what we call ultra low energy, which is where we're now, instead of, say, electricity wise, instead of using 5 milliamps, we're now going down to below 1 milliamp, 0.2 milliamps into these like 0.1 tenths of a stimulation. And we're starting to realize that, and we've had now multiple studies come out with it, that these patients are doing even better the less we stimulate the nerves. The nerves are responding longer term to lower energy. But the impact that that's going to have is, one, is obviously better outcomes. We're going to treat pain better for these patients. They'll have better functional outcomes. But then what that also means is we can make the batteries much smaller because they don't need as much energy to run it. The batteries will last longer than what we've had.
Now, so you joined Synerfuse as an advisor, but I'm assuming in your position, not many neurosurgeons in the country. You're successful at what you do. You do many surgeries, and that's probably high on the radar. You become a target for every pitch out there. People are pitching you ideas all the time. Why this specific one?
But it's one of the things I really enjoy, but it's sometimes it makes it very hard because when there's our new startup companies that are coming out, when people are looking at new technology, they'll come to me and they'll ask for my opinion. They'll want me to be involved with them. And the hard part I end up facing is I can't work with everybody. There's only a certain amount of hours in a day. And if you're like me and you're passionate about this, everything sounds great, right? Like everything sounds like it's the most groundbreaking thing that's going to change the world by tomorrow. But I ultimately have to pick and choose the things that, one, is I'm the most passionate about, do I think is the highest chance of success, but also the ones that speak to me. As a neurosurgeon who's a spine surgeon, where I do spinal fusions, and I have for all these years, but that I also saw the other side of it, where minimally invasive procedures, spinal cord stimulators that, are 40-minute outpatient procedures that you go home and recover in 2 weeks from. I was also on the other side of that. So running a practice where you're doing majorly invasive spine fusion and minimally invasive stimulators, and I saw the different results with the patients, and I had a very different outlook on those patients throughout my whole career. And how do I pick those patients for which lane are they going to go in? one of the things that just spoke to me with Synerfuse is it brought those two worlds together, which is something that I've been trying to do in my whole career for the last 15, 20 years, is trying to figure out where, well, maybe we need better patient selection on the spinal fusion patients, but also maybe we should be putting in more stimulators that are less invasive. And now we're actually molding those two worlds together, which is what spoke to me when I met the Synerfuse team.
You're probably trying to push the salespeople out of the office all the time.
It is very true. They do come by quite often. But I'm a man of, like, especially as someone who's passionate about this, I really believe in the science. And most of the salespeople who ever come to my office know they better start, if they're going to walk in, they got to walk in with papers and science and things to prove that what they have works.
Absolutely. Speaking of this, where do you see this technology in 5 years from now, Stephen? What's the evolution of this?
I will say in the next 5 years, we're going to get to the point where, one is, our results are going to be even better than this 80, 90% that we're seeing now. I think we're going to get even better. I think you're going to see a significant increase in the amount of patients that are getting this therapy. You know, historically, the problem we faced was because the therapy was upfront more expensive and because spinal fusions were just readily available and considered the standard of care, stimulators were always considered a last resort therapy. If you go, you know, so 15 years ago, everyone's like, oh, you don't get a stimulator until everything else has been exhausted for 5 to 10 years. Now that we have seen a complete change in the mindset where we're doing now stimulators before we even do spine surgery. Like we may look at you and say, well, you can go either way, but why don't we do the stimulator first and potentially just treat your pain and you're going to be fine and you don't need all the potential things that can happen with a fusion. So we saw a complete flip with that. So I think what you're going to see in 5 years is, one is, even more stimulators are going to go in. You're going to see a change in the way we do spine surgery. It's going to be a lot less of these major invasive fusions and a push towards minimally invasive procedures.
And have you, in your profession and in your, I want to say, in the practice that you do, have you looked at exoskeleton and how exoskeleton down the road could be a possibility for people who are tried the pain management way, it didn't work? Could that be an evolution down the road? I'm seeing a lot of tests on the technology of exoskeletons. I'm not sure if you looked at it or you've had a chance to read through it.
I have absolutely, and there's a lot of research that's going on with it, especially even more so with spinal cord injury, but also spinal cord injury with pain. That will be the future. I don't think that we will be at a point in 5 years where that is like the mainstream, but I do think if you look at a more 10-year mark, that absolutely will be.
It'll be there, right? So I'm seeing a lot of people, like, I've seen a lot of tests. I'm not sure if it's just, people like still testing things out, but it seems to work for where it applies. Obviously, it doesn't apply to everybody. For those extreme cases where pain management is not working or surgeries did not help, and people still young in their age, they're not advanced in their age, still have a life ahead of them, I think.
Yes.
There's some applications for it. That's what I'm reading about it.
Yes, there absolutely is.
And from your perspective, I've got to ask you the language question now. For those patients, they come to you and they don't speak English. Walk me through the process. How do you guys handle this?
Well, I would say we do use interpreters all the time. A lot of times we'll have to do it virtually. So we'll bring computers into the room and we call up an interpreter that helps us while we're in the room with the patient. But yeah, we do struggle a lot sometimes too with the language barrier, and especially trying to explain some of the things we talked about today. When I try to explain to a patient, I'm going to be putting an electrode inside your spine.
I'm assuming the interpreter has to be qualified in order for them to take your scientific English words.
Yes.
And transfer them to the patient in the same context.
We usually, there are firms that we use that have medical translators, so they're used to our terms and then how we break them down for them.
So from your perspective, where does artificial intelligence, I'm assuming artificial intelligence is helping on the development of these technologies and it drive them further, faster forward, I would say. And I don't know what your experience has been like in terms from an artificial intelligence product development part, and B, perhaps on the entire process management, from patient intake to patient management to discharge. How is that working in your environment, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody can see that AI is basically taking over everything, and it is the future. In medicine, across all specialties of medicine, it's obviously being used for intakes for patients, actually writing notes, recording your conversations and then turning them into office notes, which is meant to help the physician with the time of actually writing documentation and all. But one of the things, like specifically in our space and with these stimulators, what we're using AI for is there's algorithms that it can follow that can process much faster than we can as humans what types of ways to stimulate. So, you know, when we put these stimulators in, there's literally thousands of ways we can program them. But we get a patient to they're doing 80% better, then the question is, do you stop? Do you keep trying to program it and find another program that may work even better for them? We're now using AI to where it analyzes and can tell which programs are working best for the patient and then how to adjust those programs in real time to get the best results for the patient.
You mean the device interface to an outside device?
Yes, usually through a Bluetooth technology. So we can usually hook up via Bluetooth to the devices, change the programming that's in them. But now we're using AI to register all the different programs and which ones were working the best and then how well the nerves are actually responding. Because we can actually, one of the great things now is we don't just stimulate like a black box. We stimulate, but then record the nerve to see how well we're activating it. So we can actually tell without the patient even telling us which ones are working the best because we're recording the nerve to see how well it's being activated.
So what is your, is there a concern, let's say, when this technology goes mainstream in terms of how available is it, how supported it is? Because I'm assuming right now you're working in a very, you know, maybe one or two hospitals, but down the road, if this, and I don't know the process in the US, probably it has to go through some sort of an approval process after the testing phase. Where are you in that approval process right now? Is there any concerns down the road of this? You know, success is a good thing, it's not a bad thing, but sometimes success with no plan on how to deploy these devices at a large scale could be probably, a setback to some doctors or some patients.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you that actually the technology I was just describing to you where we're recording nerves using AI to determine the best programs for the patient, that's actually mainstream right now. Anyone who implants stimulators has access to that technology right now.
Yeah.
The real future is going to be in what they're working on is now patients are going to be able to use AI to program themselves. So they're going to be able to press certain buttons that activate certain nerves, and then the computer is going to register what that looks like and how well it got activated and change the programs accordingly. That's going to be the next big step that we're probably, and honestly, we're going to see in the next year or two.
So, and if you were to,
it's coming.
It's coming. And you know what? I'm just like wondering, because even till now, we don't have an AI chip yet. Once the AI chip is get created and AI is embedded in the actual program, right now we're managing it from the outside using AI. Imagine down the road, I'm assuming when that becomes available, and I hear it's a matter of time where we have, instead of a normal processor, you will have an AI processor inside of these devices. So now it can think on its own after certain training. That's from a technology perspective. That's my background as a technologist. I get excited about it, but I see the potential down the road for good use and for bad use. I focus on the good use for now.
Yeah, no, we're going to get there too, especially with these stimulators where there's going to have AI chips in it where it just controls itself and it'll do its own programs and adjustments and everything for the patient without any physician influence. There is obviously the concern then, though, that when you don't have oversight by a physician, that things can go very wrong when you leave it all in a computer's hands.
Of course.
You know, obviously that's a fear with a lot of things in AI right now. But I do believe that we are heading there. And in the next few years, we will have the AI chips in these stimulators.
All right. So if you were to advise a medtech company, that's the last question, I think, and we'll wrap it up, on spinal innovation in Europe, South Asia, and or anywhere else in the world for that matter for the first time, are you sharing some of that information? Are you sharing at a global community level, or are you just working on a U.S. level? Is there any interconnectivity with these types of organization outside the U.S.? Like, because I'm assuming a lot of other people can use some of the innovation that you're probably coming up with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do also lecture and talk on an international level. I'll be in Portugal actually next month for what we call the International Neuromodulation Society. We have another big meeting also coming up in Amsterdam for international spine pain and neuroscience. So I do a lot of education also internationally. What I will tell you is the future is one is minimally invasive type procedures, especially for the spine, but also just neuromodulation, meaning stimulating the nerves in every environment. We focused mainly on pain for so many years, but now that's actually changing a lot. We're treating things like migraine. We're treating things like spinal cord injury, people who are paralyzed. You know, there's companies out there now that have brain computer interfaces or brain chips where they can, you know, record your thoughts, record, like, you know, your movements, and know how it can actually activate it. So that's, I believe, especially in the next 5 to 10 years, that is the real future for what we have.
Absolutely. Stephen, did I cover everything that you wanted to cover today?
Very much so. This was actually a very fun conversation.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. It's a topic that I'm not too familiar with. I don't talk about this topic often. I walked into this conversation after a little bit of research, but I think we did well, both of us. You did better than me.
You did great. I mean, these were really good questions.
I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Stephen?
No, just that I'm very much appreciative for this opportunity. I really want to bring awareness to what we do. It is such a good therapy, and the science and the technology has improved so much. If I could bring more awareness to people just so they know it's out there, that makes me happy.
And, you know, with our audience here on the Localization Fireside Chat, they're going to take notice of that. I did connect with you on LinkedIn. I use LinkedIn to propagate some of the most messages out. Okay. And I will tag you in due time after I post-edit the episodes and launch them, etc. So you'll be aware of everything I do, and your publicist will get visibility to what we did here on the podcast together. So on behalf of I want to thank you so much for taking the time with me today out of your busy schedule. I know you just left the operating room to have this conversation with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity too.
And thanks so much for the audience for listening in. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on our podcast channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading us on the blog post, robinayoub.blog, that's where we summarize the conversations with our audience. Thank you again for all your support. Averaging 2 million viewers every 7 days on our podcast. This is not an easy feat for a small channel that started, and I didn't know anybody's going to listen to it 2.5 years ago. I thought only my mom and dad will listen to it, but there you go. I've got a little bit more than that now. Thank you again for the audience. Thank you, Dr. Stephen Falowski, for joining me. I really appreciate it. You do great work. Our heart and our prayers with you and your patients, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.